Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
In New Hampshire today, the first day of the rest of the 2012 presidential campaign. And on the ballot, when you really stop to think about it, capitalism. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 10th of January. Good to have you with us. And as New Hampshire voters do that thing they do every 4 years, long about this time, good old free market capitalism has become the key point of controversy in the Republican primary race. The more that former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney tries not to talk about it, the more we hear about private equity, Romney's last job before politics. New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore explains what the brouhaha is all about.
Private equity seems like one of those arcane Wall Street businesses, but you've seen it in action if you've ever bought sneakers at the Sports Authority, grabbed Dunkin' Donuts coffee, or a Whopper at Burger King. Those are companies owned by private equity firms. The private equity business used to be called leveraged buyouts, the old barbarians at the gate who bought and broke up companies. But private equity has changed, according to David Stoll. He's the head of the buyout lab at Northwestern's Kellogg School.
More recently, these have been investors who have not been raiders per se. These are investors who buy, fix up a company, and then hopefully sell it for more than the price at which they purchased it.
Private equity firms target struggling companies, then buy them with borrowed money provided by eager banks. The goal is to make the company profitable enough to pay off the loans. Donna Hitchrich is the director of the private equity program at Columbia Business School.
Everybody wins as long as you can pay the debt down. If you can't pay the debt down in a timely manner, that's when we have problems.
That's what happened with Simmons, that passed from one private equity firm to another so many times that it ended up stuffed with debt and went bankrupt. One publication wryly asked, how many times can you flip this mattress? Here's Hitchrich again.
Just like anything else, whether you're buying a company or investing in an individual stock, sometimes they work out and sometimes they don't work out.
There are success stories, too. Companies like the hospital operator HCA, which struggled until it was taken over by Bain and other private equity firms. It went public last year. Even so, the political accusations around job creation are beside the point, says Stoll from Northwestern.
It's important to create jobs, but that's not the principal purpose of a buyout fund.
The purpose of a private equity fund is to make money for its investors. And you may be one. They include pension funds and college endowments. They've made such a clamor to get a piece of the profits that the private equity firms are now sitting on nearly $1 trillion ready to invest. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
From the world of online healthcare came this news today. The CEO of WebMD Health has resigned. The company also gave itself a dismal financial diagnosis, saying earnings are expected to fall this year. It's kind of a surprising turn of events for WebMD, which was for a long time the company that had cracked the code for making money online. It charged premium prices for its ads as pharmaceutical companies scrambled to get their information on its site. And it makes sense, because if you've got somebody looking up migraine cures and you sell migraine medication, stands to reason, right? But what happened to the online advertising titan that was? Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has the story.
WebMD's first problem is the pharmaceutical industry itself. Blockbuster drugs like Lipitor have gone off patent, and lower profits for big drug companies mean there's less to spend on ads. Thomas O'Connor focuses on healthcare at investment bank Berkery Noyce.
Less money means less, you know, huge campaigns, and that huge campaigns means less money for all the people who live off the pharma budget.
WebMD's also facing more competition for the ads it is getting. Sites like Everyday Health and Patients Like Me. And some of those competitors offer something extra to advertisers because users register and give them personal information. Healthcare consultant Peter Frischhauf.
WebMD visitors remain anonymous, so they have a harder time following their audience's behavior.
WebMD's ad-based model has come under attack, too. The site's been accused of framing symptoms in the scariest possible way and conveniently displaying ads for a cure.
There's somewhat of a conflict of interest or a perceived conflict of interest.
James Unland with the Journal of Healthcare Finance says WebMD was a pioneer in the online healthcare field, but it hasn't kept up with the competition. The site says it's not for sale, but Unland thinks it could be an attractive buy in the future. WebMD attracts 80 million viewers a month.
I think it's a takeover target. I think that somebody wanting to get into the healthcare business, especially with the aging population, could take over WebMD and take it to the next level.
The next big level being social media, online communities, and a stronger multimedia presence. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
I am also sad to have to say this, not so much for the kids of today, but for the kids of yesteryear when parents paid less attention to what we ate. But the company behind such culinary marvels as Twinkies and Ding Dongs and Wonder Bread may be facing bankruptcy. Today, the Wall Street Journal reported that Hostess Brands is preparing a Chapter 11 filing. It would be the second go-round with the bankruptcy courts for Hostess, this country's biggest distributor of fresh bakery products. After more than 80 years in business, Hostess is still literally a household name. But our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports its familiar brands are looking a little stale.
Imagine a world without Twinkies.
You're going to risk our lives for a Twinkie?
There's a box of Twinkies in that grocery store. Not just any box of Twinkies. The last box of Twinkies that anyone will enjoy in the whole universe.
In the movie Zombieland, it was The Walking Dead who threatened to make Twinkies a thing of the past. But in real life, branding expert Harvey Hartman says consumers have simply outgrown the kinds of products Hostess Brands is known for.
It's not that we don't like them. We do like them because our mother introduced us to those brands. But they're not as relevant to us because, unfortunately, many of those brands have not changed with us.
Hartman says fresh, healthy brands are what sells these days. Bad news for Wonder Bread. At Janney Montgomery Scott, food industry analyst Mitch Pinero says Hostess has been saddled with its white bread image. Its Nature's Pride whole wheat bread has a small presence on store shelves, though sales are up. Too little, too late, Pinero says.
As a whole company, you know, it's hard to find anyone that we think would have an interest in the business. Pieces of the company, perhaps, but not the company itself.
Branding consultant Rob Frankel agrees the company might be worth more in pieces.
They may well find they can derive more value off of selling off their product lines than the actual master brand of Hostess itself.
Which may mean it won't take a gun-toting tough guy to search out the world's last spongy, cream-filled treat.
Someday, very soon, life's little Twinkie gauge is going to go empty.
Analyst Mitch Pinero doubts we've seen the last of the Twinkie brand.
It's worth something to somebody. It's probably their best asset, for good and for bad.
I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
I was always a ding-dong guy myself. Ate them on the way to school. And, Mom, now you know. On Wall Street today, traders were clearly feeling good about the coming corporate earnings season. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner found himself in Beijing today for a sales pitch of sorts. Geithner's asking China to join the United States in putting economic sanctions on Iran. From Shanghai Marketplace's Rob Schmitz reports it's gonna be a tough sell.
Usually when Secretary Geithner comes through Beijing, he's meeting with China's leaders to try and get them to do something about their undervalued currency. Beijing's usual response? Tsinghua University business professor Patrick Chovanec says Geithner can expect much of the same this week as he tries to get China's leaders on board for sanctions on Iran.
From their point of view, this is the U.S. coming over and trying to twist their arm to get them to do something that really is America's problem, not theirs.
After all, says Chovanec, nuclear weapons launched from Iran won't be heading to China. That's because China is the largest Asian importer of crude oil from Iran. Peking University's Zhao Dozhong says whether China will go along with the U.S. call for sanctions on Iran will hinge on one thing.
The big question is this just sanctions or is this the prelude to another round of military actions in the Persian Gulf?
Tsinghua University's Chovanec says China may take a wait-and-see approach for another reason.
Well, I see your customers are lining up to buy Iranian oil because of U.S. pressure. The Chinese are sort of the last best customer left standing, and that gives them a lot of leverage.
In other words, with hardly anyone left buying Iranian crude, one of China's biggest supplies of oil just got a lot cheaper. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
The number of the day this Tuesday is a biggie. Here you go. 659,210. That's the number of filings that public companies made with the Securities and Exchange Commission last year. As always, when we have questions about corporate documents and what they mean, we've called Michelle Leader of Footnoted.com. It's a virtual treasure trove of company filings. Hey, Michelle, good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
So this 659,210 filings, what's in there?
A lot of stuff. A lot of minutia, quite frankly.
But they are like annual reports and 8Ks and all that stuff.
It's annual reports. It's 8Ks. It's insider filings. It's credit agreements. You name it. It's in there.
A cynic would say that we are being buried with paperwork intentionally, that companies don't necessarily. It's sort of like the late Friday afternoon document dump from the White House or something, right? The bad news dump. And that they don't want us to be able to read all this stuff.
You know, I think that to a certain extent, that's probably true. When the company files a 4,500-page document, who do they expect is really going to read that?
Yeah.
Probably not a lot of people. I mean, I'm certainly not going to read it. Even I won't read
that's
it, actually,
right.
I should
right.
say.
whose job it is?
Probably some attorney who has to draft it. When you talk about the Friday night dump, what we found was really interesting was that, you know, there was quite a number of these filings that were coming after 4 p.m. on a Friday afternoon. Between 4 and 5:30. So the SEC doesn't stop taking filings until 5:30, even though the markets close at 4.
You've been doing this for a while. Footnoted is how old? Like 10 years old now, right?
It is 8 years old, actually. Eight and a half.
Does the public know more about public companies now than it did 8 years ago?
I think you'd be hard-pressed to say that. I mean, I think some companies are making efforts to try to, you know, be more forthcoming. But in general, there's just a lot of stuff that's just still buried in there. You know, without reading all of that 659,000 documents, you really can't say what you're missing, right?
Yeah.
You can only kind of take a guess at what you think is in there.
Give me some examples. The worst one, the most egregious offender?
Well, you know, we really liked ADP's disclosure this year, earlier this year.
It was actually people who do the payroll stuff.
The payroll, right? Yeah, back in November. And, you know, they talked about normal succession planning was the reason behind why their CEO stepped down the same day that they announced it. And then
Which doesn't usually happen.
You usually don't find CEOs of Fortune 500 companies walking away that very day. And, you know, what we found a little bit afterwards is that actually he had been arrested. It's not a funny story. He had been arrested for domestic violence. And that was the reason why he stepped down. You know, now would it have been that difficult for ADP to say, hey, you know, court situation, personal situation.
So why
did they call it natural succession
planning?
Why don't
they just do that then? That's crazy.
Well, probably because some lawyer somewhere said you can't do that or don't do it or, you know, who knows? Yeah. You don't know what's really going on behind the walls. There was also HP's severance package with Leo Pottecker that
was just out of
this world. We started doing the math and, you know, our calculator kind of blew up there. It was, you know, somewhere north of $30 million for, you know, less than a year's worth of work.
Right.
You know, a lot of stuff there that you're just finding and it's all buried and companies are just not going to put out a press release on, you know, probably 99% of this.
Yeah. Footnoted.com is the website. Michelle Leader runs it from Morningstar. It's always a good read. Michelle, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Coming up,
10, 9, 60, 90, 70, and 66. Question is, what number comes next?
Are you smart enough to work at Google? Because I'm not. But first, let's do the numbers. A good start to earnings season pushed stocks to their highest close since July. The Dow Industrials gained 69 points, just over a half percent, closed at 12,462. The NASDAQ up 25 points, almost 1%, 2702. The S&P 500 up 11 points, 0.9%, 1292. Financials were up across the board. Bank of America deposited 5.75%. Morgan Stanley advanced 4.25%. Today, automotive and consumer electronics manufacturer Audiovox rang up 20% today. That after announcing a new partnership with internet music giant Pandora. Pandora, meanwhile, gained 9.75%. Bond prices were up. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.96%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/TheBigBook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve releases its first Beige Book of 2012. It summarizes current economic conditions. How is your state doing? Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety issues its annual report card, ranking each state on adopting highway safety laws. And it's that time of year when it's all about your votes. The People's Choice Awards will be televised tomorrow night. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You may be listening to radio at the moment, or at least audio, however it's delivered to you. This week on the broadcast, though, we're all about television and the future thereof. Yesterday, I was talking to John Moe. He's the host of our Marketplace Tech Report, and he's out at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. And we were talking about how there's a whole new breed of smart televisions coming. They're basically giant computers hooked up to the internet. But hardware is just one part of that puzzle. Think for a second about what goes on the screen and about how we pay for it. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins has that part of the story.
We all know what that means. It's time for Monday Night Football on Google. Wait, I'm getting ahead of myself. That's the music for Monday Night Football on ESPN. But Google's day could be coming.
I think they'll bid on NFL rights in the next 5 years.
Mark Suster is with the venture capital firm GRP Partners.
And I think that if you can find an internet company broadcasting NFL via internet, you'll see the industry crumble.
Now, Suster may be getting ahead of himself. The crumbling industry he's referring to is cable and satellite. They still have around 100 million subscribers in the U.S. and generate around $100 billion a year in revenue. But competition is changing the way we watch and think about television. Forrester Research predicts the number of pay TV subscribers who cut the cord will continue to increase next year.
And when consumers have choice and distribution options open up, these huge fat industries with big profit margins tend to collapse and new players tend to emerge.
New players, and some old ones with new services, are streaming video to an array of devices, from TVs to tablets to smartphones. YouTube will launch 100 channels this year that range from car and driver television to something with Madonna. Netflix is taking on HBO and the networks by offering original shows. There's Hulu and Vudu and Amazon and Apple. And then there's comedian Louis C.K. His recent internet experiment sent a shiver through the entertainment industry.
Don't text or Twitter during the show. Just live your life. Don't keep telling people what you're doing. Just because also
Louis C.K. posted a video of his stand-up show at the Beacon Theater in New York. He sold it for $5 online. Over 200,000 people downloaded it. He made over $1 million, not a dime to a studio or distribution company.
I'm not like you. I'm not.
There aren't many Louis C.K.'s out there, yet. The more common model is a company like Break Media, which produces and distributes its own video. This is one of Break's first hits, a girl eating a praying mantis.
Go! Oh, no! Oh, my God!
Break brought in more than $50 million in revenue last year. It distributes videos online and through apps on smart TVs and TV set-top boxes. CEO Keith Richman is out to create a network made for the streaming era. Videos on as many outlets as possible, supported by ads.
We want to have deals with as many as we think will help influence that future world.
Because, like everyone else, Richman knows the days of forcing people to pay for channels they don't want just to get the ones they do are coming to an end.
If you're a channel that people pay for and don't know why, you have a very short lifespan.
You will have a lot more choices than you do today.
Robert Kinsel is the vice president of content for YouTube. He's overseeing the 100 new channels on the site.
And when I say choices, I don't necessarily mean just a lot more video choices, even though that's true as well, but also a lot of different ways to pay and different ways to have your content bundled.
Kinsel says there will be subscription services. There will also be individual TV shows for sale. There'll be free video, and there will be packages of channels. And eventually, your TV may be smart enough to serve up only the things you want to watch when you want to watch them. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Whatever Google might be to you, whether it's your email account, your search engine, the dominating force, dare I say, in your entire digital life, it is first and foremost a company, a place where people work. To work at Google, though, you have to be hired by Google, and that is notoriously difficult. Job interviews at Google, and increasingly other places as well, are unusual, to say the least. Brain teasers and logic puzzles are par for the course. I got a taste of that last week with author William Poundstone, whose new book is called Are You Smart Enough to Work at Google? Turns out, I'm not, but in my defense, I was sick when we spoke. Here's the first question Bill Poundstone asked me.
Okay, get a pen and write down these numbers. 10,
yep.
9,
yep.
60,
uh-huh.
90, 70, and 66. Now,
okay.
The question is, what number comes next in that series?
Are you kidding? Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. I have absolutely no idea. I'm a history and political science guy.
Yeah. Well, even if you're a mathematician, especially, you would be stumped because there's no mathematical sense whatsoever
right.
to that sequence. So maybe you should think in non-mathematical terms. And if you do that, you might try writing out the numbers and see what you
10,
get.
9.
Yeah.
66.
It works even
three,
better.
3, 4, 5, 6, right? Yeah,
yes.
So there you go.
66 has 8 letters.
8, thank you very much. So I need a number that has 9 letters in it.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
And whatever that might be.
Yes.
Right.
96 is the smallest
96.
One.
So this will not endear me to friends and colleagues of mine who have applied for jobs at Google, my brother included, I think. But it does seem a little pretentious, you know, like that. And Google, as we know, is a company with an attitude. I mean, it's a little bit, you know, they're better than we are and they just want to stump us and have a good time at what seems to be our expense, right, making us squirm in these interviews.
There's an element of that, I think. But they ask this because it's engineering. You're inventing a new product. And a lot of the questions they ask at these technology companies are really designed to see if you can recognize that there are simple solutions as well as more complicated ones.
So we are here at Marketplace. There are some open jobs. We're going to have job candidates coming through, as all companies do. Is this mechanism, these brain teasers is too simple a word, but you know what I mean. Are these kinds of questions good for non-technical companies?
These kind of very challenging questions really have spread throughout the economy, partly because of the very tight job market. There's a website, glassdoor.com, where people will post interview questions. And I've actually used that to trace the spread of these. And now most of them reported are from non-technology companies, from Aflac to Volkswagen. So it's really become pretty prevalent.
Is there a way that you can prepare for these? I mean, you know, you can prepare for what are your biggest weaknesses, right? I could go into an interview today and figure that out. What about these tougher sort of more challenging questions?
Certainly one of them is with all these questions, the first thing that pops into your head is going to be wrong.
Yeah.
So you should
say that again.
Yeah.
A good life lesson.
So you should realize that. And actually, so that you have something to say, start talking about, well, the obvious answer would be this, but explain why it's probably going to be wrong. I mean, the interviewer does not have a particular answer in mind. They want to see the thought process.
It does seem, I guess this would tell you more about somebody than tell me about a time when you failed.
That's one of the things they try to address. Interviews tend to be conversations where you kind of do chit-chat, and they found that that's a very poor predictor of how you're actually going to perform on the job. So they want to get something that's a little more like the types of mental challenges that you might actually be confronting.
Also, those conversations, those tell me about a time when you failed conversations, I mean, those are just deathly boring. They're boring
yes.
for you as a prospective employee, and they're boring for, you know, the person doing the interview.
Yeah, people have learned the safe answers to give
right.
to that, so they want to shake up things a little bit with these questions.
Right. You got another one for me?
Okay, suppose you're shrunk to the size of a nickel and thrown in a blender. Now, the blades are going to start spinning in 60 seconds.
Yes.
What do you do?
I lie down, right? I'm the size of a nickel. Those blender blades are, in theory, a millimeter or two higher than a nickel. I lie down and those blades go right over my head and I'm fine.
The answer that a lot of people came up with is that you would just jump out of the blender. You can do that, and you can use physics to explain how this would actually happen. And that's considered a good creative answer.
Yes, and once again, I'm not smart enough to work at Google. William Poundstone, his book is called Are You Smart Enough to Work at Google? Thanks a lot.
Good to be with you.
That part you heard about marketplace hiring, it's true. So we came up with some Bill Poundstone-approved public radio interview questions for all you potential applicants out there. They're on our website, marketplace.org/thebigbook. Check them out, even if you don't need a job.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, another entry in the Who's Who on Twitter sweepstakes. Celebrities and the president and basically big names all get a little blue verified checkmark on their accounts. And a report in Ad Age today says one way to get verified is to spend $15,000 on Twitter advertising. I don't have that kind of money, so my Twitter account isn't verified. But I did notice that somebody else you probably hear a lot on the radio is. So we called him up, Guy Raz, the host of Weekends on All Things Considered, and we asked him how he did it. Hey, Guy, how are you?
How are you?
I'm all right, but listen, I have a question. So you've got, what, like 4,000 Twitter followers?
A little bit more than that. You know, not as good as you.
Well, I was going to say, I have a multiple thereof, and yet I don't have that little verified check mark. How'd you get that?
Well, you would think you'd have to be really important.
Touche, yes.
And it turns out that you actually don't need to be important or that well-known because I am neither of those things. And yet I have that verified check on my account, right?
Yeah.
So the story is there's a guy named Eric Kuhn, and he works for the United Talent Agency.
Wait a minute. Are you telling me I need to get an agent? Is that where we're going?
He came by and he mentioned that, you know, we should all have those verified accounts. And literally within a day or so after that, I had that check mark next to my name.
I am so calling my agent as soon as I get one.
Yeah, you got to call this guy.
I'll do that.
Yeah.
Thanks, man.
Hey, no problem. And by the way, I just want to let you know how many people thank me for all the financial news they get from my program.
That's right. Yeah. And they love me on Weekend All Things Considered.
Thank you so much.
All right, we'll see you. You get it? Guy, Kai, happens all the time. Can't tell you how often that happens. All right, that's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 69 points, just over a half of 1%. The NASDAQ up 25 points, almost 1%. The S&P 500 put on 11 points, 0.9%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time back here.
I tell candidates, it's always better to be the candidate with the most money, but you can win without it.
Primary economics, Freakonomics style. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM. That's American Public Media.